If the clerk will please announce who's arguing.
May it please the court, Mr. Jason Steed to argue for the appellant, Mr. Sean Cox to argue for the appellant.
All right. All right, thank you. Mr. Steed?
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jason Steed. I represent the appellant in this case. This is an appeal from the denial of a motion to compel arbitration. This is the question, the only question that the court needs to answer in this case is whether the plaintiff's claims fall within the scope of the party's arbitration agreement, which is a legal question. It turns on the court's interpretation of the agreement itself. So I want to focus on the language of the agreement. But before I do that, I want to establish the legal context for reading an arbitration agreement and how that agreement should be interpreted. And to do that, I'm going to quote some language from a couple Supreme Court cases. The first is a case, it's In Re Rubiola, which is 334 Southwest 3rd 220. The actual case is not necessarily important. I'm just quoting language that's familiar to every case that ever deals with the interpretation of an arbitration agreement. And this court has actually quoted the same language in the In Re Scott case, which we cited in our brief. In this case, the Supreme Court says, when deciding whether claims fall within an arbitration agreement, courts employ a strong presumption in favor of arbitration. Any doubts as to whether claims fall within the scope of the agreement must be resolved in favor of arbitration. And the policy in favor of enforcing arbitration agreements is so compelling that a court should not deny arbitration unless it can be said with positive assurance that an arbitration clause is not susceptible of an interpretation which would cover the dispute at issue. So the main point that I want to make there is that if it's at all possible to construe this agreement as applying to the plaintiff's claims, that's how the court construes it. The second case I want to point to is In Re First Texas Homes. It's 120 Southwest 3rd, 868. Again, the actual case is not, we're not relying on the details of the actual case, but I want to cite this legal language for interpreting the agreement. The Supreme Court in this case, though, does cite to a case, the Prudential Securities case, which we cited in our briefing. And there are some details that the court refers to that are relevant to this case. Here the Supreme Court says, whether claims are arbitrable under the Federal Arbitration Act, and the parties here agree, there's no dispute over the fact that the FAA governs this agreement. Whether claims are arbitrable under the Federal Arbitration Act must be determined under federal law. We are obliged to resolve any doubts about this issue in favor of arbitration. And then the court refers to the Prudential Securities case and says, in Prudential Securities, two stockbrokers sued their former employer, alleging that it had made defamatory statements about them after terminating their employment. So facts that are very similar to the facts alleged here, claims similar to the claims that are alleged here. In that case, the court goes on, we held that these claims fell within the party's employment agreement to arbitrate any dispute, claim, or controversy that may arise between them. Now, this is the language I want to point out here. In the present case, the party's agreement to arbitrate all disputes between them is equally broad, and the plaintiffs have offered no reason why all does not mean all. So again, the legal context here for interpreting this agreement is that the court will construe the agreement, if it's at all possible to construe the agreement as applying to the claims, then that's how it will be construed. And if the parties said that the agreement applies to all claims, all means all. And the Supreme Court has upheld broad arbitration agreements, and where the parties say all means all. So turning to the actual agreement itself here, this is page 35 of the record. I think it was Exhibit B in our appendix. The third sentence of the introductory paragraph says, the employee agrees to submit all claims as outlined below to binding arbitration. And then below, in Article 1, the first sentence, the employer and the employee named below agree as parties to this contract to the resolution by binding arbitration of all claims. The agreement then lists three exceptions, none of which are at issue here. The plaintiff has never asserted that any of those exceptions apply. So we're left with, if we set those aside, we're left with all claims. Skipping down in the middle of that Article 1, it says the claims that otherwise would have been decided in a court of law, whether local, state, or federal, will instead be decided by arbitration whether or not the claims subject to this agreement arise out of the employee's employment, remuneration, or termination. So whether or not the claims arise out of employment, all claims are subject to arbitration. Skipping down to Article 2, the claims covered by this agreement include but are not limited to, and then skipping down, claims for personal, physical, or emotional injury arising from negligence and any intentional tort. The claims asserted here are a claim for negligence and two claims for intentional torts. So the arbitration agreement specifically refers to claims that are being asserted in this case. And then skipping over to Article 4, and this is a key provision in this case, Article 4 states, this agreement shall survive the termination of employee's employment and may only be revoked or modified in a written document that expressly refers to the agreement to arbitrate claims that must be signed by both the employee and the employer and a witness. This agreement is binding on all parties, including the employee, their personal representatives, spouse, children, agents, successors, and heirs. Article 4 is important because it establishes that the arbitration agreement, this contractual relationship between the parties, exists separate from and beyond the employment relationship. There are two relationships here. In order to become an employee, the plaintiff had to sign this agreement. But even after the employee is no longer an employee, the plaintiff is still bound as a party to this arbitration agreement, which only makes sense if the arbitration agreement contemplates encompassing claims that might arise after employment. Otherwise, there's no need for this survival provision.
Well, couldn't it also mean claims that arise before termination but that aren't asserted until after termination?
Well, if the agreement applies, and everyone agrees on this, if the agreement applies to claims that arise during employment, there's no reason for the agreement to survive employment. The claim might be brought at any time, 2 years after employment, 5 years after employment, as long as there's not a statute of limitations problem. Anytime that claim is brought by the plaintiff, everyone's agreeing that the agreement that covers a claim that arises during employment for arbitration. So the agreement doesn't have to survive termination. The agreement covers a claim that arises during employment, and it's still going to cover that claim even if the claim is brought later. The only reason to have the agreement survive termination is if the agreement's going to apply to claims that might also arise post-termination. Otherwise, the survival provision doesn't make any sense.
I've seen arguments made that it no longer applies. In other cases, that their arbitration agreement no longer applies because their employment or their contract or whatever the substantive part was is terminated. Therefore, there's no more agreement, there's no more arbitration.
And that's certainly the argument that the plaintiff is making here, that this only applies to claims. The plaintiff is arguing that the survival provision here is talking about claims surviving termination. The problem is that's not what this provision says. This provision says this agreement shall survive termination, not the claims. The claims that arise during employment, sure, they might be raised later, but this is saying the agreement survives termination. And so again, if we have two relationships, we have an employment relationship and then we have a contractual relationship under this agreement, the employment relationship might end. But this contractual relationship under this agreement survives, even when the employment relationship has ended. And the plaintiff remains a party to this contractual relationship. And again, the Supreme Court says all means all. And they've contracted under this agreement that all claims will be subjected to arbitration as long as this agreement's enforced. Now, the agreement could be revoked or modified by agreement of the parties. That's what Article 4 says. So if the parties agree to terminate this arbitration agreement at some time or modify it in some way, then they could do that. But until they do that, there's no expiration date here. The agreement clearly applies to all claims for however long there might be any claim between the plaintiff and the parties.
In perpetuity.
Yeah, until it's modified or revoked.
What about the slippery slope argument that the appellee makes with respect to that argument you're making, that what if in 20 years, what was the?
The car accident.
Car accident, yes. Can you respond to that?
Yeah, there are two responses to that. The first most direct response is those claims are covered by the plain terms of the agreement. The agreement has no expiration date. It says all claims, unless there's some basis in the language of the agreement to say those claims are not covered by the agreement, they're covered. That's the most direct answer. The more practical answer here is it doesn't matter. The court doesn't have to decide the entire scope of all possible hypothetical claims that might be subject to arbitration under this agreement. Whatever hypothetical claims might come up 20 years from now, it just doesn't matter. All that matters here is whether these claims fall within the scope of this agreement. And under the plain terms, the agreement says whether or not the claims arise from employment, they fall under the scope of this agreement. Here, we actually have claims that arise from employment and termination. The allegations here are that statements were made about employment and about termination that allegedly prevented the plaintiff from getting a job with a prospective employer. Those claims that are being brought arise from these alleged statements that clearly relate to the employment relationship. In fact, the plaintiff is seeking to benefit from the employment relationship by listing Savoy Healthcare on her resume or as a reference or in whatever way she's using that employment experience and that employment relationship in order to try to get a job somewhere else. She's seeking to benefit from that relationship while at the same time seeking to avoid the obligations that she entered into under the arbitration agreement as a result of becoming an employee in the first place. So our argument is here, again, regardless of what hypothetical claims in some distant future, whether those might fall within the scope of this agreement, here, these claims clearly fall within the scope of this. Now, the plaintiff does argue that the scope is much narrower, applying only to claims that arise in the workplace. The language that the plaintiff seizes on to make that argument is from the first sentence of the introductory paragraph of the agreement. So I'm going to look at that really quick. That first sentence says, alternative dispute resolution is the preferred method for collegially and internally resolving differences that may arise in the workplace through grievance and staff complaint procedures. Now that use of the words in the workplace, that's the only time that appears in the entire agreement. It's the first sentence of the introductory paragraph. The plaintiff argues that those three words in that first sentence restrict the scope of claims that are subject to this agreement to only claims that arise in the workplace, and that's all that's subject to arbitration. The problem with that, well, there are two, probably more than two, but I'll only talk about two. The problem with that is that first sentence doesn't say anything about claims, and it doesn't say anything about arbitration. It's talking about alternative dispute resolution as a preferred method of resolving differences that might arise in the workplace. So just in the plain language of that first sentence, there's nothing about restricting the scope of claims that are encompassed by the arbitration agreement. The second problem is that if you go down to the third sentence, the employee agrees to submit all claims as outlined below to binding arbitration. That's the sentence that says the scope of claims that are covered by this arbitration agreement is defined below. By looking at the first sentence and ignoring the third sentence, the plaintiff is trying to restrict the scope of claims based on that first sentence when the agreement actually excludes the first two sentences. The agreement says that the scope of claims that will be subjected to binding arbitration is everything below that. So the idea that the arbitration agreement is restricted to claims arising in the workplace is just simply not supported by the language of the contract. The other argument that the plaintiff makes is that somehow these first two sentences created a requirement for our alternative dispute resolution before arbitration could be pursued. Again, the first sentence simply states a preference for ADR procedures as a way of resolving differences, and then it says that if that doesn't work out, arbitration will be the method for resolving disputes. There's no language that supports the idea that there's a requirement for ADR procedures to occur before arbitration can be pursued. And then the second part of that is the U.S. Supreme Court, I believe it's in the Howsam case that we cited in our briefing, but the U.S. Supreme Court said that if there's any kind of condition precedent to arbitration, which is essentially what the plaintiff is arguing this is. The plaintiff is saying there's a condition precedent to arbitration insofar as there has to be these ADR procedures. The Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, has said if there's a condition precedent to arbitration, the arbitrator decides whether that's been fulfilled. So the proper course for this court would be to simply order arbitration, order the parties to arbitration, and then if this really does constitute a requirement that we've got to go through before we can arbitrate, the arbitrator decides that. So it still doesn't prevent the case from being ordered to arbitration. If the court has no further questions, I'll wait for rebuttal.
All right, thank you, Mr. Steen. Mr. Cox?
Please the court. My name is Sean Cox, and I represent the appellee, Erica Mammon. Now, I won't go into any discussion of the facts except to point out that the claims that we're discussing here arose 6 weeks, approximately, after termination of employment. The claims are for defamation and tortious interference with a prospective contract, essentially. Another employment job, you know, another contract with another employer. This has nothing to do with a condition of employment, with termination of that employment, any event that actually happened during employment, or that arose out of the workplace. Now, the key issue here, as with all arbitration agreements, is to determine the intent of the parties. In doing so, the court harmonizes all the provisions so that none are rendered meaningless or superfluous. Now, in doing so, I'd like to point out two rules of construction that I know the court is aware of, but are of particular relevance here. That is that one provision should not nullify another, and that terms stated earlier in an agreement, such as in the first paragraph of an agreement, prevail over subsequently stated terms. Now, this is relevant because in this first paragraph of the agreement, the parties define the universe of claims to which the arbitration agreement is applicable. And they do so by stating that the alternative dispute resolution is the preferred method for internally resolving claims that may arise in the workplace through grievance and staff complaint procedures. Now that first right there, the key language is may arise in the workplace. Because you have to look at this with the second sentence of that first paragraph, which states that arbitration is the chosen method for resolving disputes if informal ADR methods prove unsuccessful, that the parties have chosen arbitration to resolve those disputes. Now that defines the universe of claims that we're talking about. The other provisions that follow later may narrow or include certain items within that universe, but if the claim that's in dispute or the issues that are involved in the case do not satisfy that first paragraph, then it can't satisfy any of the rest of the following provisions that include or exclude certain provisions, because this is the only place, this first paragraph is the only place where a claim is actually defined, and that is it arises in the workplace and ADR procedures have been unsuccessful in providing a resolution. Now,
well, is it your position that they are a prerequisite on the condition that exhausting remedies?
Yes, it can be looked at as a prerequisite, but it's more of a definition of what claims are subject to this arbitration agreement, as opposed to whether it's a prerequisite. But they're saying at the very beginning of the agreement, both parties have said that the only claims we're talking about here are ones that arise in the workplace and for which ADR procedures have been unsuccessful in resolving. In this case, as I already mentioned, it did not rise. No claim arose in the workplace. These claims all arose 6 weeks after termination. They don't deal with termination. There was no claim of discrimination or even mean words being said in the termination proceedings. This all has to do with statements that were defamatory and were made after 6 weeks after and tortiously interfered with a prospective employment contract.
But they all arise out of the workplace relationship that the employee had with this employer.
It It might arise from that, to a degree, in the sense that the defamatory comments discussed, her employment with them. But it did not arise in the workplace, because she was not in the workplace for 6 weeks. And the later provision, which the appellants have asserted controls here, is that it, regardless of whether it involves the employee, I think it was arises from employment, that's different than arises in the workplace. It's a more narrow provision. There could be events that had nothing to do with that had nothing to do with employment that still arose in the workplace, a slip and fall, or an office party where a fight broke out, something of that nature. That wouldn't be related to employment or in the scope of employment, but it would still arise in the workplace and be subject to this kind of agreement. But post-termination defamation claims cannot fall under this narrow definition of what the universe of claims are.
Mr. Cox?
Yes, Your Honor.
The same paragraph, the opening paragraph, refers to the employee agrees to submit all claims as outlined below to binding arbitration. Now, what you're asking us to do is read the first two sentences, but not to read that third one.
No, Your Honor, it's actually key to read the third one as well, because that refers to claims, all claims. But the first two sentences define what those claims are. So if the claims satisfy, the ones that are outlined below, satisfy the first two sentences, then yes, it would be arbitrable. But it says all claims as outlined below, but claims is defined in the first two sentences as those arising in the workplace and for which ADR resolution has been unsuccessful. So therefore, the third paragraph does not trump or redefine what a claim is. That a claim is defined in the first two sentences.
Well, if it may arise, that means that it may arise in the workplace, or it may arise elsewhere in other places. How can you interpret may arise in the workplace to be conclusive in terms of where claims arise as outlined in other portions of the agreement to arbitrate?
Well, I think because, and again, going back to the rule of construction, that what comes first prevails over subsequent terms, is that may arise in the workplace. That's a recognition that what the parties intended in this contract is to address claims that arise in the workplace. And you can't find the definition of claim by just looking at that first sentence. You also have to look at the second one, which is where ADR procedures have been unsuccessful in resolving those claims. Those are the ones that the parties agree to submit to binding arbitration.
But your client didn't attempt any ADR proceedings.
She was no longer an employee. She hadn't been for 6 weeks. That those were not available to her any longer.
Well, if the agreement has a survival clause and says that it survives the employment relationship and goes then into a different phase of post-employment activities, then she might have, in terms of your position, still have asserted an ADR claim.
If the definition of a claim reaches into the future to address post-termination torts, and if the survival clause actually provides that vehicle, actually makes those post-termination torts arbitrable, then perhaps that would be true. But in this case, the survival clause does not have that great of a reach. Survival clause is there for situations where a tort that arises in the workplace and for which ADR procedures have been unsuccessful, that arbitration will still be required even if the employment relationship is terminated. Otherwise, an employee who was bound by an arbitration agreement could be injured at the workplace and then just merely quit and not be bound by the arbitration agreement. The survival clause provides that even if the employment relationship terminates, that claim is still arbitrable. If an assault happens during the course of a termination proceeding, employment would be terminated, but yet that assault claim would still be required to be arbitrated. It does not say, and this is what's key here, is there's no language saying that post-termination claims are covered by this agreement. And that's what was included in their primary case, which they cite for arbitration of post-termination defamation claims, is In Re Choice Homes. In that case, the court seized on, to the exclusion of all other terms, two phrases. One was that the arbitration agreement that all claims in dispute that the employee may have or may have in the future, they combined that with the phrase that disputes may arise between the company and the employee during or after the employee's employment. Those two terms, those two phrases, are what the court latched onto and determined that that was why the arbitration agreement applied to future claims that happened after termination. That language or anything like it is completely missing from this agreement. It simply was not the intention of the parties to arbitrate these claims. Now, one key factor, one thing to look at in determining what the actual intent of the parties were here is intriguing. It's the motion to compel itself, which on the first page of the motion to compel, page 24 of the record, they state that the arbitration agreement dealt with claims arising from Ms. Mammon's employment and or termination from employment. That's their understanding of the arbitration agreement, at least when they filed their motion to compel. It wasn't that it reached beyond to post-termination proceedings. They claimed that the reason this claim was arbitrable was because it was arose out of termination of employment. That was their understanding. That was the universe of claims that they believed when they filed their motion to compel. That was what was included. We agree that claims arising from employment or termination of employment would be arbitrable, but this is not one of those cases. This happened far after termination. They admit that under their interpretation, it lasts in perpetuity. Any claim forever in the future that might arise between the two, regardless of whether it has anything to do with employment, that would require arbitration. That seems to me an absurd result when the more reasonable interpretation and one provided by the language here is that arbitration of disputes is only required for disputes that arise in the workplace for which ADR procedures have been unsuccessful.
Is there an employee handbook or is there a contract that the employee signs that sets forth the specific provisions for filing grievances and then either party invoking informal or formal alternative dispute resolution?
Not in the record that I'm aware of, Your Honor. I believe the only things that are on the record are the actual arbitration agreement itself.
Okay.
One thing I would like to point out is when appellants opened their argument, they focused a lot on this preference for arbitration under the FAA, and that this court should prefer and favor arbitration. That the language and structure of the contract, as the Fifth Circuit has held, trumps any kind of preference. You only get to a preference when there's a doubt, such as when there's an ambiguity, and there isn't an ambiguity here. Not if you apply the rules of construction and look at the contract as it reads. There's no reason to apply any preference. Further, they have not asserted this federal preference until, I think now. It may have appeared in their reply brief in this case, but I believe they have never actually, in their briefing, asserted this federal preference for arbitration, which this case is governed by federal law and by the FAA. And the First Circuit has held that if you don't raise it until the reply brief of in the Court of Appeals, that you've waived any kind of reliance on some kind of asserted preference under federal law.
What about the position that's taken by the appellate that the determination is to be made by the arbitrator as to the applicability of the arbitration agreement?
That's not in line with federal or Texas law. It's only if there would be an ambiguity as to whether it was covered or something like that.
Good. Well, let me ask you this. The three things that were the statements that are listed in your brief on page 2. Plaintiff, on her termination, was escorted out of the building by police. Now, that would have been a part of workplace activity, wouldn't it? In the building, that's a workplace.
Well, yes, but it's under our claim for defamation. That never occurred.
All right.
The actionable, the action in this dispute is the false statement made 6 weeks after termination as to what happened
during termination.
False statement
that there were any police escorting her out.
Yes.
Secondly, they worked for the plaintiff worked for 2 years and not six. That'd be a workplace issue, wouldn't it?
Again, Your Honor, it's not, that's not what is at issue. It's the defamation. It's the defamatory statement.
Well, is it true or not true?
Oh, it's that it's not true, that she actually did work there for 6 years.
All right. What about the last one, that plaintiff was a lazy worker and not rehirable?
That would be, I forget, I believe that the laziness would be untrue, but I suspect that the rehiring would be true.
So your contention about those statements are that they're just simply not true, all three of them?
Yes, Your Honor, and that they occurred, you know, that they occurred much later. So even if they mention the employment relationship, it's actually not.
The statements were made later, even though the things that are described in the statements would have been in relation to the workplace.
Yes, or at least into the employment.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your
Honor. All right, rebuttal, Mr. Steed.
Just a few quick points, Your Honor. My friend from the other side is asking this court to believe that claims as a term in this agreement is defined by the first two sentences of the agreement, even though the word claim or claims never appears in the first two sentences of this agreement. The court is being asked to believe that that's where the definition of claims exists, is those first two sentences, even though the first two sentences say, alternative dispute resolution is the preferred method for collegially and internally resolving differences that may arise in the workplace through grievance and staff complaint procedures. It's talking about differences that may arise, and there's a stated preference for alternative dispute resolution. It does not talk about claims per se, and it doesn't talk about the scope of an arbitration agreement. The third sentence says the employee agrees to submit all claims as outlined below to binding arbitration. Any suggestion of any attempt to define claims or the scope of claims subject to this agreement comes in the third sentence and says that it will be outlined below. Those are the plain words of the agreement.
So are you saying outlined essentially means defined? Defined.
Essentially, below. Right. That the claims that are subject to this agreement are outlined below. And that the several times the agreement states all claims. The parties agree to arbitrate all claims. There are three exceptions to that, none of which are at issue here, which means what we're left with is all claims. Now, I would suspect that the plaintiff would say, would based on her argument, would have to concede that if she were a current employee who went to try to find a job somewhere else and statements were made, allegedly, about her employment status and her performance, and she was allegedly prevented from getting a job somewhere else. She hadn't yet been terminated, but there were statements made allegedly that prevented her from getting a job somewhere else. Based on the argument from the plaintiff, I would infer that she would concede those claims would be subject to arbitration as a current employee. Exact same claims, the only difference being whether she's a current employee or not a current employee. The argument from the plaintiff is essentially, my claims would be arbitrable if I were still an employee, but I'm not now, so I don't have to arbitrate. The problem with that is that survival provision, which states this agreement shall survive termination. It's not about claims that arose during employment. It's about this agreement surviving termination. It doesn't matter if she's an employee or not an employee. And Article 1 says it doesn't matter if the claims arose, it says whether or not the claims arose from employment. So it isn't about claims arising from employment or as an employee or not as an employee. The plain language of the agreement says these claims, any claims, all claims, and as the Supreme Court says, all means all, are subject to arbitration here. As far as the ADR procedures not being available, alternative dispute resolution just means, hey, can we work out a settlement here? I got a complaint. I want to negotiate some kind of resolution. I want to enter into mediation. At any time, the plaintiff could have called up Savoy Healthcare and said, I've got some concerns about what was allegedly said about me. I want to work something out. There's nothing in the record that says she ever did that. There was nothing. She wasn't denied any access to alternative dispute resolution. There's no language, again, there's no language in the agreement that says the scope of claims subject to the agreement is limited to during employment or arising in the workplace. Aside from the sentence that states a preference for ADR procedures, there's no other mention of claims being limited to in the workplace. I think I may have covered all my points. If the court doesn't have any other questions, I'll cede the remainder of my time.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Steed. Thank you, Mr. Cox. We appreciate you all coming over to our court today. We appreciate counsel's attendance, all of your arguments, and of course your briefing in this matter as well. So your case is now submitted, and that was our last case, so we will now adjourn court.